Hi, and welcome to Offensive Shadows,
your weekly visit with Abroad, Her Bud, and the Bard.
I'm Mike.
I'm Danny.
And welcome back for part three of the Comedy of Errors, the wrap-up.
Slash, things we haven't talked about yet. Including perhaps one of the most important parts of this play, which is its setting. Ephesus is really more than just a city. And most of the play is performed in the streets of Ephesus, especially those parts having to do with the men. The women's parts are at home until they decide to take to the streets later on, which is particularly fitting because the show is a lot about domestic things becoming aired in the wilderness of commerce, I guess.
Aired on the street, so to speak?
Yeah, aired out on the street. Like when Antipholus decides that he's had enough banging down his own door, so he's going to go find a...
A courtesan.
I was going to say hooker, so...
Yeah, well, yeah. I find it really interesting. I know Shakespeare does this in some of his other plays, that where the play is set in ancient Greece, everyone's Christian. You know, we have a pre-Christian setting, but Christian tropes, Christian titles, Christian religious figures.
Well, it's especially interesting because Ephesus is a city strongly associated with sorcery, exoticism, mystic cults, and early Christianity.
It's actually a really interesting city. Before this play, I had never even really heard that much about it. It's got a great cool history to it.
Yeah, it's one of the seven churches of the apocalypse, or churches of Asia. I just think churches of the apocalypse sounds way cooler than seven churches of Asia.
The city itself?
The city itself, yeah.
Is actually the city itself is a church?
It houses one of the churches. I don't know. I looked on Wikipedia, okay? Leave me alone. It's cited in the Book of Revelations. It's also the site of several 5th century Christian councils, aptly titled the Council of Ephesus. Paul lived in Ephesus for a time, and the Gospel of John might have been written in Ephesus.
So it's actually got a pretty, pretty strong connection to Christianity.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, besides that, it houses the Temple of Artemis, which is one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, so it's got a strong religious connection prior to Christianity, but definitely a strong early Christian.
So Ephesus, as portrayed in the play, though, is almost like a crazy urban jungle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although more like a Disney urban jungle.
Okay, so this play, and any of the mistaken identity plays, so like Twelfth Night, have this thing where the place where the mistaken identity occurs, it has to be crazy enough that the characters begin to doubt themselves. They question their own sanity, whether they dream. The outside characters, that is, so the Antiphilae and the Dromios. The world around them needs to be colorful and confusing enough to support this very valid conclusion of these people are talking to me like they know me, calling me by my name, but they're saying things that I don't have any recollection of. Like, obviously, they know something I don't know, so either they're all crazy or I'm crazy. And a good example of this comes in the final courtesan scene.
Yes, yes. Where both parties leave the courtesan scene thinking the other party is absolutely mad. Where we have the courtesan showing up to talk with one of the Antipholus, or when the Antiphilae
snuffle up a guy,
finds the wrong one, and they proceed to have a conversation where one thinks the other is crazy. I believe Antipholus and Dromio run away thinking she's a witch, and the courtesan's, well, you've gone nuts. I'm never getting my money back or my ring back, and decides to report the fact that poor Antipholus is off his rocker. In fact, we have this craziness scene for you right now.
There's not a man I meet but doth salute me as if I were their well-acquainted friend. And everyone doth call me by my name. Some tender money to me, some invite me, some other give me thanks for kindnesses. Even now a tailor called me in his shop and showed me silks that he had bought for me. Sure, these are but imaginary wiles, and Lapland sorcerers inhabit here.
Master, here's the gold you sent me for. What, have you got the picture of old Adam new apparelled?
What gold is this? I understand thee not.
Why, sir, I brought you word an hour since that the bark expedition put forth tonight, and then were you hindered by the sergeant. Here are the angels that you sent to for to deliver you.
The fellow is distract, and so am I. And here we wander in illusions. Some blessed power deliver us from hence.
Well met, Master Antipholus. I see, sir, you have found the goldsmith now. Is that the chain you promised me today?
Satan, avoid! I charge thee, tempt me not!
Master, is this Mistress Satan?
It is the devil!
Nay, she is worse. She is the devil's dam. Come not near her.
Your man and you are marvelous merry, sir. Will you go with me? We'll mend our dinner here.
Master, if you do, expect spoon meat, or bespeak a long spoon.
Why, Dromio?
Marry, he must have a long spoon that must eat with the devil.
Avoid then, fiend! What tell'st thou me of supping? Thou art, as you are all, a sorceress! I conjure thee to leave me and be gone!
Give me the ring of mine you had at dinner, or, for my diamond, a chain you have promised. And I'll be gone, sir, and not trouble you.
Oh, some devils ask, but the parings of one's nail, a rush, a hair, a drop of blood, a pin, but she, more covetous, would have a chain. Master, be wise, and if you give it to her, the devil will shake her chain and fright us with it.
I pray you, sir, my ring or else the chain. I hope you do not mean to cheat me so.
Avant, thou witch! Come, Dromio. Let us go.
Fly pride, says the peacock. Mistress, that you know.
Now, out of doubt, Antipholus is mad. A ring he hath of mine worth 40 ducats, and for the same he promised me a chain. Both one and the other he denies me now. The reason that I had gathered he is mad is a mad tale he told today at dinner of his own doors being shut against his entrance. Be like his wife, acquainted with his fits, on purpose shut the doors against his way. My way is now to hie home to his house and tell his wife that, being a lunatic, he rushed into my house and took perforce my ring away. This course I fittest choose, for 40 ducats is too much to lose.
And one of the things about Antipholus that, like, Viola and Sebastian don't have is Antipholus has Dromio, right? So even though there is a fair amount of Dromio swapping going on in this play, there's still a foil to be like.
There's a sounding board for the poor guy saying, "Am I crazy? Are we both crazy? Because weird stuff's going on."
Yeah.
And they reinforce each other by saying, "Hey, we're both encountering weird stuff." Dromio's like, I mean, from the country scene, Dromio is explaining that I ran into somebody who thinks, you know, she's my girl. I've never seen her before in my life.
And Antipholus is just kind of amused because, of course, he's having the same problem. The thing about Ephesus and this play in general is it undermines everyday life. Normal things like invitations to dinner, the bond between husband and wife, the operation of civil and commercial law become strange and unusual when they are acted upon or by a stranger. So all it takes is this one person not being who you think they are to set the entire world into this, like, crazy chaos.
And we see this from the very start of the play with Aegeon's rather unreasonable sentence at the beginning, where he's sentenced to death unless he can, you know, pay a ransom of 1,000 marks, which is probably a little extreme.
Yeah, it's always bothered me that, so the laws in this world prohibit travel between Syracuse and Ephesus, and if any citizen be from one city be found in the other, he's sentenced to death. His goods are confiscated unless he's ransomed with the payment of 1,000 marks. It's like trade embargo to the extreme. And I'm like, really? Is that necessary? You can't just send the poor guy home packing. He's probably going to die on the ocean anyway.
And what's funny from that beginning scene is the Duke decides to grant him some mercy and allow him to make the ransom. And he gives Aegeon a day to raise this huge ransom of money and then orders him escorted off. Yeah. The jail. So where is he gonna raise the money from?
The other thing I've always thought was funny, I mean, down the line of Aegeon's family, is the abbess who turns out to be Aegeon's wife, and by the way, is probably a priestess of Diana at that temple I was just talking about, has been in Ephesus for 23 years without proclaiming herself to her son, who she knows is also at Ephesus. What?
That's a good point. I had missed that. But yeah, she must have immediately gone into the abbey and never told Antipholus of Ephesus, hey, I'm your mom.
Why would you do that?
It may have been just something along the lines of she took shelter in the abbey and therefore couldn't publicly acknowledge him and raised him at the abbey.
She's a priestess of Diana. They're heathens.
Well, she's actually not a priestess of Diana, though. She's an abbess. She's a Christian abbess.
Well, except you can't portray a Christian abbess on stage. So
it's true. It's true. It's just
kind of a priestess of Diana.
But kind of not. So as we see with Dr. Pinch, whose services are obtained to expel the madness from the poor Antipholus and Dromio, he starts using Christian phrases and Christian wording to attempt to exorcise Satan from the poor duo.
It's funny because there really are so many parallels between this and the other Mistaken Identity play, Twelfth Night. I know I keep bringing it up, but we also have a Christian exorcism attempted on stage in Twelfth Night.
But surprisingly, I mean, obviously, as we mentioned in, I think, Shrew, it's not an actual priest and it's done for comedic effect.
Right, because you can't do Christian ceremony or ritual on stage.
And Pinch is clearly displayed as an incompetent buffoon. He is named as a doctor and a conjurer and a schoolmaster, I think, in just the script. I don't think the text actually mentions him as a schoolmaster.
Yeah.
But he is clearly not competent to be doing what he's doing, at least for the audience to perceive. And the craziness of Ephesus, however, he's the best they got.
It's funny because Antipholus of Syracuse declares at the very beginning of the play that he's going to lose himself to find his brother and mother. And that's exactly what he does on the streets of Ephesus. He loses complete sense of identity, complete sense of self, and complete sense of anything, really. And then eventually finds his brother and his mom.
Mission accomplished.
Hey, go Antipholus.
With much hilarity and strife. Although this play isn't really all that big on strife. There are a lot of bad things that happen, but they get rectified very, very quickly.
Well, the entire play happens quickly. It takes place in a single day because old Aegean is arrested in the morning and then his execution's in the evening. It's actually one of the only plays of Shakespeare that adheres to the Aristotelian unities.
And the Aristotelian unities are?
The Aristotelian unities are three aspects of specifically tragedy that Aristotle cites. Well, poorly translated Aristotle, but that gets into a whole tangent about other things. But poorly translated Aristotle cites as vital to high tragedy. And the first is the unity of action. So a play should have one main action that it follows with, like, no subplots off on the side. The unity of place is the second one. It should cover a single physical space and not try to, like, move around a whole lot. So none of this Othello world hopping sort of globetrotting. Or even Two Gentlemen of Verona, where we're all over Italy.
Or Henry V.
Or Henry V, yeah. And the third is the unity of time. The action in a play should take place over no more than 24 hours. And I think this is the only one of Shakespeare's plays that actually does all three of those things.
It is definitely a tight play. I mean, not much in the way of subplots. It's pretty direct. It's, you know, takes place in the course of the day, because after a day, poor Aegean's going to be executed.
Well, I also think it's interesting that he chose to use the Aristotelian unities in a play that's
set in ancient Greece.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's almost no chance that was an accident.
Check it out. My man Will was super smart.
So over the course of Acts 4 and 5, our heroes go from being declared insane to finding their mother in an abbey and finally meeting their opposites. And everything turns out fine as Antipholus of Syracuse happens to have the 1,000 marks his dad needs.
Hey, check that out.
So we have a happy ending at the end.
Although I've always wondered why it was that Antipholus and Dromio of Syracuse weren't also arrested when they revealed that they were, in fact, from Syracuse.
That's a good question.
Good job, Shakespeare.
Perhaps a small plot hole.
No, Shakespeare doesn't have plot holes.
But so overall, what did you think of the play?
I love this play. I really wonder, and the more I think about it, the more I wonder this, why it's not performed more frequently. It's tight. It has a small cast. There's not a giant demand for sets or props or costumes.
It's short.
You don't have to cut it. The only reason I can think of why people would not perform this play is they are intimidated by having to pass off two sets of identical twins on stage.
Which is completely unreasonable.
Yeah, dress him in identical clothes, get two dudes of like approximately the same stature, you're fine.
I mean, you might even be able to take the Arnold Schwarzenegger Danny DeVito twist on it too, and have, you know, quote unquote twins, one being 6'7", one being, you know, 3'5".
I really and did not would, need that visual.
And it would be funny. It would be perfect for this play.
Arnie and DeVito as Antipholus. And
yes.
Anyway, the BBC version cheated. They used the same actor twice, and the magic of cinematography created two sets of identical twins out of two actors.
Which in that particular production doesn't bother me. Unfortunately, most of the rest of the production, it does, you know, does bother me, with the exception of Act 1, Scene 1, which they did a great job in staging.
Unfortunately, there's not many other versions of this to be seen. There's the Stratford Shakespeare Festival, which is a Canadian Shakespeare festival, has a version, but the text is heavily cut because they included song. So it's supposed to be quite good, but I've never seen it. And then there's an RSC production with Dame Judi Dench, but it's only available in Region 2. It broke my little heart. It's supposed to be amazing. Someday I'll get my hands on this DVD and watch it. But if you're here in America, you're pretty hard up for Comedy of Errors. There's also a Broadway musical, Boys from Syracuse, which I don't know very well, but it exists. So there you go.
So if you do happen to notice a production of this play being put on in your local area, I highly suggest that you go. It's probably going to be pretty good. The play itself, I think, is one of the more accessible Shakespeare plays, especially for someone who has not seen Shakespeare before. It's a very simple plot. It's very straightforward. The language is easy to follow. It's kind of a perfect beginner Shakespeare play.
It really, really is. And the only thing that sometimes causes trouble on stage is that a lot of it's written in heroic couplets, which is iambic pentameter, rhyming couplets. So it can get a little Dr. Seussy if you don't know what you're doing, but
I think that's actually pretty good for someone who has never really had to listen to Shakespeare, because it's in the rhyming pattern. It helps you follow it.
I've always found it distracting, but I've been doing this since I was 8. So anyway, we hope you'll join us next week. We're going to be working on one of my favorite shows, Love's Labor's Lost.
Should be a good one.
God, I love Love's Labor's Lost. And if you want to do your pre-research, you can watch the Branagh version. Or there is an RSC version, which is available in Region 1 format, so you can actually watch it.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Offensive Shadows would like to thank Mr. Christopher Knowles for the wonderful logo art, Mr. Matthew Rosevalley for the beautiful music, and the vocal stylings of Ms. Lisa Dacak, Mr. Angelo Calderon, and Gavin Fishman.
Yay, work paging me.
It wants to be a star.
Can I hear where I left off? Or work so rudely interrupted us?